We're going to take a brief station break and we're back looking into why white so-called Christians who engage in murderous attacks against other religious groups in America are not labeled terrorists. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Brian Levin, who's a criminologist, civil rights attorney, professor of criminal justice, and director of the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at California State University San Bernardino, where he specializes in analysis of hate crimes, terrorism, and legal issues. Previously, Professor Levin served as Associate Director of Legal Affairs of the Southern Poverty Law Center's Klan Watch Militia Task Force in Montgomery, Alabama. Welcome to Background Briefing, Brian Levin.
Thank you so much for having me, Ian.
And this latest shooting by an extremist here in the United States, where the extremist was captured on television shouting Heil Hitler after he'd shot Christians, as it hasn't happened, at a Jewish center. It's already, the feds are already stepping in, looking into the aspects of hate crime. But just for the benefit of our audience, Brian, I mean, isn't this terrorism? I mean, it's obviously a hate crime motivated by hatred, but it seems, you know, to also, we never really talk about Christian terrorism, not that this guy was necessarily a Christian, but I'm wondering, you know, why it is that most of the charges against him, except for the feds, just business as usual in terms of criminology. This feels more like a political crime to me than a run-of-the-mill murder.
I think you're absolutely right. And one of the things that, you know, I'm going to do is just tell you how the feds make their decision. If it's a domestic extremist that is not acting on behalf of a larger conspiracy or group, they will formulaically charge it as a hate crime. And so what happens is, because they have a working rule on how they operate, that this distinction is often something that the public takes some issue with. In any event, the fact of the matter is the penalties are going to be the same. That is, when a death results from a hate crime such as this, the death penalty comes into play. And that would be the case if this person was charged under terrorism laws, which are generally prosecuted, again, with regard to those who are acting in support of some larger entity.
So would you accept the premise, Brian, that we, you know, we talk about Muslim and Islamic terrorism all the time, but we don't, we seem to be very nervous about describing Christian terrorism, and there's been a number of incidents of it, not the least of which was in a church in Oklahoma, where an abortion doctor was killed in the name of Christianity. I just, you know, since the word terrorism is bandied about so much and it carries so much weight and such a strong stigma, it feels like we're letting a lot of our terrorists off the hook.
That may very well be right. In this case, he actually has criticized Christianity. So for this particular individual, he's probably more of a Christian identity-oriented fellow, which pretty much rejects Christianity. He certainly in his writings has criticized Christianity, but he has used words like starting a Christian army. But his definition of Christian is so far removed from mainstream Christianity that most often people don't do that. Now, to the extent that we have perhaps a double standard in when we have Salafist jihadists acting in a manner that is anathema to mainstream Muslims here in the United States, I think you make an excellent point. And that was something I tried to make with Bill Maher last year, who painted all Muslims the same with respect to their interpretation of scripture. So I think, again, as you continually do, make an excellent point that in the way that we designate these, that there is a degree of inconsistency when it comes to white domestic extremists versus Middle East extremists who are lumped into being called Muslim. If I may also say, many of the people who are labeled as Muslim extremists are oftentimes folks who are, again, on the fringe, their recent converts. There are people who have mental illnesses. There are people who are sociopaths who bounce into this orbit and in prior generations may have gone to another antisocial extremist ideology, but just happened to be ensnared here. And I think what we end up doing, as I think you are alluding to, is creating a situation where we're causing fear of mainstream Muslims across the United States, millions of whom are completely law-abiding and whose version of Islam is not at all threatening in the least.
So then perhaps, Brian, we're attributing too much to this fellow. Maybe he's just not particularly bright. I recall there was also another shooting in Wisconsin at a Sikh temple where this white supremacist shot a bunch of Sikhs thinking that they were Muslims. And in this case, presumably he thought the people that he shot were Jews, given that he was clearly has a poisonous anti-Semitic background. But his membership in Nazi groups goes back to, 1976, when he was still in the army, and he did two tours in Vietnam. And then he got into a violent battle in 1979 in Greensboro, North Carolina, with Nazis and Klan members on one side and communists on the other, that left five of his adversaries dead. It's amazing this guy's still walking around. I mean, what happened? Did he do time?
Not in that one, and I don't believe he necessarily fired any shots in that particular attack. Even if he did, all of the folks that were charged and prosecuted in that particular 1979 incident were acquitted. And I mean, if there is a guy who had hit the lottery with respect to his commission of crimes relative to the time served, I think Miller, who I knew him as, that was his name when I was tracking him in the 1980s, really did hit that jackpot. He could have spent basically a lifetime in prison. He cut a deal with the feds after going underground, declaring war on the federal government, Jews and others, and he kept these arsenals of sophisticated military weapons. By his own admission, when he was arrested, he had C4s and all kinds of military heavy weaponry. Prior to that, he even had anti-tank rockets, law anti-tank rockets. So this is a guy who actually, the biggest punishment for him was the fact that he was exiled by the movement that once embraced him. Because once he became a state witness, he only served 3 years in prison out of five for cutting that deal, which, by the way, all the defendants in the trials that he was involved with as a witness also were acquitted. I don't want to say it's a comedy of errors, because it's not. This was a terrible thing all the way around. But this was someone who was exiled, you know, by his community, made some inroads over the last decade with certain pockets of the hate world, and was notorious with regard to making thousands of posts on the internet. But he really ceased to be a leader with this world that had collapsed on him based on him being a witness. Prior to that, he really was a pioneer. And just briefly, he was one of the key folks who Nazified the Klan, who militarized the Klan. As you said, spoke of raising a Christian army to declare war on the United States. He got $200,000 from a group called the Order, which committed a laundry list of crimes, including a multi-million-dollar armored car heist. So in the 80s, he really was at the center of much of the hate activity that was going on at the time. Yet, like a musical artist or a ball player that hits his zenith in one decade and then in subsequent decades is barely heard from again, I think that's what happened. And I think because he was exiled and because he wasn't taken as seriously as he was heretofore, perhaps this attack was really one final whimper of trying to gain relevancy, legitimacy, or rehabilitation in a world that really had abandoned him.
Well, Brian Levin, though, it's hardly a coincidence that he's caught by the feds with lots of military weapons, which were clearly stolen from military arsenals, and he's trying to form a Christian army at the same time. And the Order, the group that you mentioned, not only did they do the $3.6 million Brinks armored car heist in Ukiah, California, they also shot, of course, the Denver radio host, Alan Berg, did they not, in 1984?
Yes. You know, by some counts, these folks committed scores of crimes. And there is a debate whether or not he was actually a member of the Order, though not involved in its central core, or whether he was merely a beneficiary of the Order. Either way, we know for a fact that he met with Robert Matthews, who was the leader of the Order, who died in a fiery shootout with the FBI in Washington State in the mid-'80s. Miller was someone who, frankly, would have been much more likely to have committed something like this in 1986, 85, or 87 than today. He was someone who all of us in the hate monitoring community knew. We saw his posts, but I think many people thought that he was virtually irrelevant, which ironically might have been the catalyst to him going out and doing this. A guy like him in his 70s, who once headed groups that had 1,000 members, now living, you know, in rural Missouri without a following, really, this was, I think, an attempt to define his legacy, and with tragic result.
Well, clearly, Brian Levin, this fellow's stature in the hate world was damaged by the plea bargain that he did with the U.S. government. He also ran for the U.S. Senate in 2010 and received 7 votes. So his political career wasn't exactly a successful one. But, you know, both of us had to sort of, we have to sort of pinch ourselves here for not laughing at the absurdity of this all, but this is lethal absurdity. Lives were lost, you know. This fellow, of course, had access to firearms. It's amazing that he was able to buy the weapons used in this murder, apparently from a straw buyer. So, again, you know, you're left with the recognition and the realization, surely, Brian Levin, that one, you know, the FBI, for as much as it does infiltrate these groups, and the Southern Poverty Law Center, I know, gives the FBI an awful lot of information to act on, but they're still these guys are able to create mayhem, and they're able to get weapons. I mean, that's a pretty lethal combination, isn't it?
And if I could compliment you as one of the voices of folks who has warned against far right-wing extremists. I'm not talking about conservative people of goodwill here who we might debate from time to time. I'm talking about the hardcore, violent, radical right-wing extremists is a danger in the United States. And certainly, federal law enforcement knows this now, and they are taking significant measures to stop this. With respect to another point that you are making, you are 110% correct. And that is these folks who are often almost comical in their presentation represent one of the most significant domestic terrorism risks, as well as being among the least likely to capture and deter. Violent, hateful loners like Cross or Miller, as we used to call him, can do massive damage, and I'm talking not just killing a small number of people, but dozens or more, with relative ease based on the information that's available within their communities and on the internet. And I think that's one thing that we worry about and that we consistently plan for, and that is a loner, smaller, autonomous cell, and that's coming across a broad spectrum that includes extreme radical Salafists or others to commit mass terrorism on a much more significant scale. Look at what we're observing today with respect to Boston. Believe it or not, that Boston tragedy with respect to fatalities could have been much, much worse. And that is what we really, I think, have to pay attention to. And again, something that you have so credibly have done is pointed to this risk, which comes from the extreme radical right. We can laugh about these people. We can say, oh, okay, this guy did a terrible thing. But there is a significant risk that is even worse than what we saw in Overland Park, Kansas over the weekend. And we continue to worry about it, and it's something, as I said, that is difficult to deter and something that does require some significant resources. And I applaud you for, again, paying attention to this issue, because I think a lot of people shrug it off when they shouldn't.
Well, Brian Levin, it's a phenomenon, isn't it? Your previous employers, the Southern Poverty Law Center, they have counted 939 hate groups in the United States in 2013. And the federal government statistics show that there were 5,796 hate crimes reported in the United States in 2012. 1,166 were committed on the basis of religion, with 59.7%. Or 674 anti-Jewish, and as it happens, with no fatalities. So this is not an isolated incident. This problem has metastasized in our society. And how do you root it out, do you think?
First of all, excellent point. One of the things that I think is so interesting is hate crime, most of which are committed by young males or young male adults, has actually gone down because a lot of the loose cherries were shaken off the tree with the passage of these statutes throughout the United States. And people who have relatively shallow bigotry, in other words, they go out as part of a group for excitement and they get drunk, are less likely to go out and commit these things. What we now see is a remaining core of folks. And even that 939 number of hate groups is a decline from the last couple of years when the number of hate groups peaked. Nevertheless, what I think where there is a real risk is not in this kind of thousands of hate crimes which we see every year, which are terrible. I think the risk that we see is something that you had alluded to in your previous question, which is, what are we going to do with the next fellow who does not just kill a few people, or is not just caught in a plot or an attempt, but actually is able to carry out a mass attack which kills many more? And that's what we really worry about. Yes, there is the continuing terrible existence of hate crimes, but we're really near 14-year lows with respect to reported hate crimes, or 15-year lows. And that, unfortunately, continues, and it ebbs and flows. And we have to respond to that. But what I think we continue to worry about is, having a domestic Andres Breivik over here in the United States, or another Timothy McVeigh.
Well, Breivik, of course, killed, almost 100 people, and methodically and hideous. So, but that's not to say that this guy didn't end up with assault rifles and C4 plastic explosives. He had the potential, in many times in his past, has had the potential to do enormous damage.
By all means, and we see these kind of plots happen quite a bit. One of his pen pals wanted to blow up a Martin Luther King Day celebration in 2011, which could have killed scores of people or injured many people. So we see plots, we see examples of people who had some kind of sophistication. This fellow Miller is an Army veteran. These people have the motive, the opportunity, and at least the training, and it's a lot of times it's just a matter of dumb luck or timing that more people weren't killed, including over the weekend. And we're really worried about that. When is the next extremist going to hit that fatal hockey puck through the goal and kill many more? And I don't mean to minimize what has happened, but those of us in the monitoring community really do gird for this, because we are seeing plots, and I don't want to go into detail, that could result in a massive loss of life.
Well, Brian, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
As always, thank you so much, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Brian Levin, who's a criminologist, civil rights attorney, professor of criminal justice, and director of the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at California State University, San Bernardino, where he specializes in analysis of hate crimes, terrorism, and legal issues. Previously, Professor Levin served as Associate Director of Legal Affairs of the Southern Poverty Law Center's Klan Watch Militia Task Force in Montgomery, Alabama. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about the bombing in Nigeria and the abduction of schoolgirls by Boko Haram.